Hi, welcome back. So, I've spent most of the day trying to figure out what it is I do here, because I wasn't here last week. So, you get a Caribbean cruise paid for by somebody else for a week, you eat too much, the wind is blowing too hard to go swimming or snorkeling most of the time, you're herded around with 3,000 people on and off the ship, and when you get off, what you can do is shop, and I'm not ungrateful, it was a great time. But the highlight for me, you have to know. The highlight, after we got off the ship, we were spending the night in Orlando, so we rented a car, drove up a little bit north, and spent 2.5 hours talking with my mother's 96-year-old cousin. And we just told him we were coming. I called him and said, hey, we're going to come visit. Is that okay? And he said, yeah, the place is a mess. Mess, but come on up. So we did. He was very happy to see me for the first time since I was about 8 years old. And he remembered funny stories about that particular visit to me. I think he was actually thinking of my brother, but I didn't correct him. But anyway, there we were. And it was delightful. The 96-year-old who's intellectually capable and spry and fit, and physically bad knees, but he was up and about. Yeah. So, when you're a human developer, you get more fun out of that than overeating and seeing Mexico and places like that. Okay. The sociologist in me enjoyed the poverty in Belize. Social structure on the boat. What? Yeah. And of course the family systems person in me loved being with 12 of my wife's relatives, including both of her parents. So, anyway, that was fun. And the snorkeling in the Bahamas was wonderful. Now, where were we? Oh, yeah. What did I have for Thanksgiving dinner? Grilled sea bass. They had turkey, but it wasn't very good, so I had the sea bass. All right. Enough about me. Where were you? Did you get any work done? Neither did I. So, welcome to the club. Did you have any fun? Okay. Did you lose sleep? Did you catch up on your sleep? How many of you caught up on your sleep? How many of you broke up with a significant other? How many found a new one? Congratulations. Both. Congratulations. And how many of you came back roaring to go and ready to finish the semester? A couple of you. How many of you are still trying to figure out why you came back? That's right. Welcome back. All right. Here we go. That's the distribution of total points at this point. That's everything we have, not counting the exam analysis, which is optional, which is coming in on Wednesday unless you turned it in today. Do we know what the average is? No. We should. Always. So, I'm going to guess that the average is 108. Okay. So, you can check me on Wednesday and find out if I'm right. So, what this means is, if I had to assign the final grades today, which I don't, but if I did, I would cut this distribution in various places, and these people would get A's, and there would be A minuses and B's of some sort, B minuses and C's and C minuses and a D plus and a D. So that's the way it works. What you have is another writing exercise, the exam analysis, and a final exam, which will add a lot of points and will spread this out. It'll get flatter and there'll be more spaces in it, so it'll be a little easier to cut. But it's a completely arbitrary system based on those who have the highest points, most points get the highest grades, and so forth. But I'm not nasty. I don't get my kicks out of failing grades. I'm thinking. I'm not. You will have access to it. I'll post it in our office or outside our office. What I'm questioning is whether I have the technological skills to scan it and actually put it online. I think I do, but I'm not going to promise. Okay. But Talia wrote that down, so you will have access in some way. Yeah, it's not a secret. Here it is. There was another question. No. There was a stretch. Okay. Questions otherwise? No? I was talking about Sullivan. You were enjoying learning about Sullivan, so I'm going to go back and talk about Sullivan a little bit more because we didn't quite wrap him up. For those of you who missed it, the overheads are online, and the bare necessities are that Sullivan's attempt was to describe development in terms of the significant relationships that we develop as we mature, the variety of those and the nature of those and how important they are in our development. So he was a constructivist looking at the way we create the skills of relating to other people, the emotional responses we have in those relationships, and how they contribute to our shaping up of a personality and a way of being with other people. So that part is online. Actually, all of this is online. And where we were was looking at his notion that we can talk about people as having interpersonal needs. And he suggested that there were three needs, interpersonal needs. We have all the biological needs and probably some cognitive needs, but interpersonally, what he suggested was that we have three, and we're born with a need for security, and when our relationship or any significant relationship is threatened, as it's not secure, we feel anxiety. And when we feel anxiety, we either try to change our behavior to make the other person like us again or comfortable with us again, or we avoid the relationship. And that experience of the need for security comes along with infants, and the potential for anxiety is part of our initial equipment, and we keep those the rest of our lives. So in any significant relationship, there is a potential, when that relationship is threatened, the potential is to feel anxiety. And we adapt our behavior, we adjust our behavior, We change our behavior. We inhibit our behavior. We hide our true feelings. We hide our feelings generally. We stuff them, or we express them appropriately in order to reduce the anxiety and bring the relationships back to a secure state. When we get up toward adolescence, the end of childhood, we begin to feel the second interpersonal need, the need for intimacy. And we know that we feel that because we experience the absence of intimacy, and that feeling, that emotion is loneliness. That feeling that we can be in a crowd and have nobody really know us, know how we feel, care about us, want to understand us, nobody that we understand or we know closely enough. So the experience of intimacy in a relationship is the sharing of feelings and ideas and knowing that you are accepted in part because you share experiences and feelings, and that you are able on both sides to be interested in and comfortable with the other person, even if you're exploring feelings and ideas that may be new or may not be comfortable. So we develop a sense of intimacy, the need for intimacy, and then we create intimate relationships by learning to express ourselves in ways that don't threaten other people. We learn to listen. Excuse me. I didn't talk much for a week. We learn to explore other people's feelings, to hear them, to help them express themselves in appropriate ways. And in the process, we're creating a relationship that we can both depend on. And when we have relationships like those, we call them close friendships. We call them intimate. They may, in fact, become romantic, but that's not necessary. So the skills of intimacy are developed across adolescence as we practice having relationships in which we share our thoughts and our feelings with each other. And I think about the last thing I said was that on Wednesday a week ago was that the process of creating an intimate relationship in which you really express yourself and share your ideas and your feelings with another person honestly and hear that person's feelings and talk about them in a way that makes the relationship stronger, the process of doing that often threatens our security. And I mentioned junior high school as the place where we often experience anxiety when we are trying to establish friendships, close friendships, best friendships with other people, as we learn the skills of being friends. And ideally, by the time we get through adolescence, we've learned to have an intimate friendship that is secure. Now, the process of developing intimacy in adolescence is complicated by the fact that that need shows up as a result of cognitive changes as we move toward formal operational thinking. It shows up just a little bit before the need for sexual gratification, which is the third interpersonal need in Sullivan's scheme. So what happens is we start feeling horny or lusty or desirous of sexual contact with other people, and we start pursuing that with other people during adolescence. And that, as you know, can create anxiety. The great value in Sullivan's theory, from my perspective, the great value is that he separates these two needs and says they are different, they are separate, they are satisfied in completely different ways, And human problems often come about, particularly during adolescence, because we confuse them. We get them tangled up. Ideally, where we are going in adulthood is to have a relationship, at least one, that is secure and intimate and sexually gratifying. But as we develop, we have to learn to have secure relationships. We have to learn the skills of intimacy and put those together in friendships that are secure. And then we have to, after courtship and marriage, of course, figure out how to have a sexually gratifying relationship with somebody with whom we are also intimate and in a way that makes for a secure relationship. So the ideal, in Sullivan's view, was that you would be able to have many kinds of relationships that are secure, that people don't make you anxious every day, and you have some of those secure relationships which are intimate, your close friends, lovers, spouses, and you have at least one that is also sexually gratifying. And that one should include the satisfaction of all three of those needs so that you are not anxious, you're not lonely in that relationship, and you are experiencing at least adequate sexual gratification. So Sullivan says the problems we have in adolescence are because in our culture we don't teach people about intimacy. We don't teach the skills of intimacy and friendship. We don't encourage emotional expression and expression of our feelings with other people. We don't teach kids how to do that. Kids teach each other how to do it, but that's sometimes a very anxiety-producing process. We don't actually teach how to have a sexually gratifying relationship either. Peers teach that to each other as well, or the media do, misteach it. But if we're not teaching it directly, then there's a lot of experimentation going on in adolescence and continuing into adulthood, trying to figure out how to have a relationship that doesn't make us anxious all the time. In the process of developing intimate relationships, Sullivan says that we're starting out from the friendships that we had in childhood, and we're typically in elementary school sticking with our own kind most of the time. So the boys have their culture and the girls have their culture. And so if you're going to start feeling the need for intimacy, it's likely that your first best friend where you practice those skills is with somebody who is the same sex. So it's likely to be what Sullivan calls a homophilic relationship, philic from the Greek for love. You learn to have a relationship that is close and intimate with a best friend, junior high school best buddies and on through high school, and for some of us on through the rest of our lives. And then we also develop intimate relationships that are heterophilic, as with the other sex. Sullivan says that's harder because the other sex is different, has a different way of being, comes from a different culture. Doesn't mean you have to have the homophilic relationships. It's just that many of us find it easier to talk about our emotions and our feelings with somebody of the same sex when we're children. Remember, we're junior high school here. And then we transfer that skill to heterophilic relationships. Many people develop them, heterophilic relationships first. It's mostly a matter of accident. Sullivan says some interesting things, such as it's easier to develop the homophilic relationships because we're similar to each other. The more similar you are in your thoughts and your feelings, the easier it is to share them and understand each other's. And it's easier, he says, to transfer that or to apply those skills to the other sex if you have siblings of the other sex, particularly if they're older, there's an interesting hypothesis there that if you have, for example, if you're a male with older sisters, it's going to be easier for you to develop close friendships with females because you've had the practice, you know how, maybe, how women feel, how girls feel and think and talk, so you've learned to get along with them, if you've learned to get along with them, in the sibling order, and similarly in the other direction. So girls with big brothers have an easier time, he says, of creating heterophilic relationships. Then what happens, he says, is that as we're exploring the intimacy, we're also going through puberty, so we're likely to do some homosexual exploration. And he was pointing out that when you're talking about what's going on in your life and you're going through puberty at the same time, and you're talking to your best friend as you're developing those skills, it's likely that you will do some homosexual exploration in that relationship just as part of establishing the intimacy. And he cited Kinsey's work, which was published during the same period of time, which pointed out that well over half of males do have homosexual experiences during early adolescence, and some proportion of women, a lower proportion. It's a common event. And in Sullivan's view, it was simply a normal part of developing the intimacy with a same-sex buddy or chum or friend. And then, as we go through adolescence, we move toward heterosexual relationships, most of us, and those he considered to be more normal. I'll say more about that in a minute.
Yeah, what do you define as experience, and wouldn't that be homoerotic behavior?
It would, in our current terminology, be called homoerotic.
And what do you define as experience?
Hmm?
As homosexual experience, what would you define that as?
Mutual masturbation, observing each other, exploration, just exploring the body, touching, masturbating with each other. In his view, it doesn't usually go any farther than that. In part, it doesn't go much farther than that because it scares the hell out of kids. Because, remember, the kids who are going through this in our culture are in the most homo-hostile social institution ever invented, the junior high school. If you want to find a place where homosexuality and homosexual behavior, homoerotic behavior, is abnormal and socially proscribed, the junior high school is the place. With all the language, all of the misunderstanding of lifestyles and sexual orientation, kids are still trying to figure out what they are. So anything that might be different is denigrated and criticized and commented on, and you end up being harassed, and if you're even thought to be too close, particularly to your male buddies, which is one of the reasons that intimacy creates so much anxiety, because in order to be intimate, you have to talk about your feelings and you have to talk about them with somebody who is a peer. And if you're too close to your buddies in our culture, you're at risk. You can play football and pat each other on the butt, but you can't cry with each other. You can't talk about how you feel about anything in the junior high school. It's inappropriate. So Sullivan said, we need to understand that there are a lot of kids who have what we would now call homoerotic experiences, male and female, in early adolescence. And he said, we just need to understand that and not worry about it, because it's not predictive of a identity as homosexual. And we don't need to worry about it. Which was very helpful to me. I used this once when I was working in the child guidance clinic at the University of Minnesota, because I had parents who brought a child in, an emergency. I got a call in my office. I was a graduate student. The clinic supervisor said, I have parents bringing an 11-year-old boy in. They say it's an emergency. They are on their way. Nobody's around. Can you see them? Okay, what kind of emergency does an 11-year-old kid have with his parents? I'm not too good at crisis intervention. So they came in. They wanted to talk without the son. The night before, his best friend had been over visiting. The best friend was 12. Mother went in the bedroom without knocking, scurrying inside, and the 12-year-old and the 11-year-old were both putting their pants back on. Mother called for father. Father threw the 12-year-old out of the house, told him never to get there, never darken their door again, and immediately brought the next day, brought the 11-year-old, whom he had by this time scared shitless. I didn't say that. But that's what had happened. And, yeah, it is on. Sorry, that's clinical language. I'll explain it to you later. Anyway, the father had... So they brought the kid in, and they wanted me to make sure that he didn't become homosexual, because this other boy clearly had been seducing him. And their son could not have been interested at all, but they were afraid this one experience would turn him into a fag. That was their language. And he would be queer the rest of his life, which would be a terrible, terrible, terrible tragedy. Remember, we're talking about 1966 here, so nothing like that would ever happen now. Right. So anyway, I talked to them. I talked to the kid for a little while. He was relieved that somebody wasn't going to jump down his throat. And he allowed us how they'd been talking about puberty and how many pubic hairs they had, and they were trying to figure out what was going on in their lives, and they were wondering if their testicles, they both knew that their testicles were getting larger, and they were kind of interested in the comparison, and so that's what they'd been doing, and it was mutual, and there was nothing else going on. And so anyway, I told him not to worry about it, it was completely normal and all that. Just lock the goddamn door. Anyway, so then I talked to the parents, and I don't know that I did an awful lot of good. Mother was okay. I used Sullivan. I said, well, you know, they're 11 and 12 years old. They're going through puberty. They're curious. And their school doesn't have any kind of human development in it. And so I asked the parents what they had taught the kids about puberty, and nothing, of course. What they had learned about puberty when they were going through puberty, all of those things to make them feel inadequate and guilty so they'd get off the kids' back. Right. So I did. They did, I hope. The irony here, the really interesting irony for me, is that here's Sullivan saying that the homosexual, homoerotic exploration that happens in early adolescence is perfectly normal and doesn't mean anything, and we will all eventually become heterosexual and have a heterosexual relationship that is intimate and secure, and that is the normal way. He was fully aware that lots of people are not heterosexual, but he was a product of his own psychiatric training, which back then was still defining homosexuality as a psychiatric disorder. He was writing in the 40s and 50s, early 50s, died in 53. So he was writing at a time when homosexuality was a psychiatric disorder, and it wasn't until the 70s and 80s that that got challenged and changed. The irony is that Sullivan himself was homosexual, which might have contributed to considerable loneliness on his part. He never married. He was partnered for a little while, but that's never written about and described. It's also questionable whether he drank himself to death or committed suicide. Anyway, he died young, in his 50s. So, where do we go with that? One more important point that these needs, in his view, are hierarchically important. Security is the most important need, intimacy second important, and sexual gratification third important. And what he argues is that, and points out from case material, is that people will do almost anything to maintain secure relationships, but there are people who don't have any relationships that don't cause them anxiety, and that's a really, really difficult way to live. There are people who have relationships that are secure and intimate without sexual gratification, because sexual gratification creates too much anxiety. Now, the interesting support for the hierarchical nature of these for me is conversations that I've had with people who are celibate by choice, priests and nuns in the Catholic tradition, who forswear sexual gratification. And one of the first times I was teaching about Sullivan while I was in graduate school, it was a summer course, and I had a number of nuns and several priests in the class, a lecture not quite this big. And I went through the Sullivan stuff, and I talked about the hierarchy and the fact that some people will give up sexual gratification in order to maintain the intimacy and security of a relationship. And lots of people do that. So I had this one guy who'd been asking all the really, what he thought were challenging questions all summer. And he was sitting right behind the nuns and priests who tended to cluster together in the middle of the room. He raised his hand and he said, "Is it really possible to live without sexual gratification?" I said, "Well," and I knew the priests and the nuns fairly well. And said, "Well, we have experts here, so let's ask them." And the one who was Mother Superior in a convent high school said, she was great. She said, "Yeah, you know, I really like Sullivan. I want to read more about him because he's really describing the experience very nicely, because sexual gratification is very, very difficult to give up. So we know it's a very strong human need. And it is the primary reason why the girls who take initial vows don't go on into sisterhood. They drop out because they can't give it up." And so that's our primary reason for losing our students who are novitiates. So they just can't deal with it. And then one of the priests who was he was also a psychologist, said, "Yeah, you can do that, and it's not easy." He said, "Just let me tell you, it's not easy. But you can do it because within religious orders you have incredibly intimate, strong friendships. And those bonds make it possible to live your life without the sexual relationship." He said he didn't think he could be a priest if he wasn't able to enjoy very, very strong, very close, intimate relationships with other people, including priests and nuns, without the sexual gratification. He said if you couldn't do that and have those be secure, it wouldn't work. So that was one bit of evidence that I've cited over the years, and I keep checking out with celibate acquaintances. The other is, do you know how Masters and Johnson, you know the names Masters and Johnson? Now, they were this couple who did sex therapy. They kind of invented couples sex therapy and opened a clinic in St. Louis that was very famous. I think one of them is dead, the other one is old. Anyway, they don't do it anymore. But they had a technique for dealing with couples who were having sexual difficulty. And these were couples who had had often years of lousy sexual relationships that were dissatisfying, and they just didn't want them anymore. And they were at their wits' end, how to save a marriage without the sexual gratification. So Masters and Johnson had a technique. You signed up for a week, you left your kids and your work behind, and you came together as a couple to St. Louis, and you had to check into a hotel, and then you met with them on Monday morning, and they would do a history. And as they did the history, they'd also do physical exams and make sure that nothing was wrong with the basic equipment. And they would spend Monday talking about your sex life and your relationship. At the end of Monday, they would send you back to your hotel, and they would say, okay, now, a rule here. You may not attempt any kind of sexual contact until we tell you you can. So a couple would go out to dinner, they'd have a glass of wine, they'd watch TV, whatever it was they would do. Tuesday, they'd come back in, there'd be more of the same, a little bit of education, interviews separately and jointly about the relationship, and Tuesday, same rule. Tuesday night, the couple would go out and they would have a couple of drinks and they would talk about how weird Masters and Johnson were and anything else that came up. Wednesday, same thing, but more information about sexuality and communication. And either Wednesday or Thursday night, many of the couples would break the rule. And they would come in the morning, Thursday morning or Friday morning, and they would say, well, we broke the rule, are you going to throw us out? Masters and Johnson would say, well, why did you break the rule? And they said, well, we were talking, you know, we've been talking all week. The first time we've been away from the kids, or the first time I haven't been allowed to work in the evening or required to work in the evening for years. And so we talked, and it's the first time we've talked in years. First time we've talked about what was really important and what was going on in years. And they were able to break the rule because they were meeting the more important needs. That allowed them to have a sexually gratifying experience. What happens in relationships is that people either never establish intimacy. You can have sex without intimacy, but you can't maintain a long-term relationship that is intimate and sexual, or that is sexual without the intimacy. It's going to be satisfying to both people. It's just not going to happen. So what Masters and Johnson knew was that you had to create a secure situation and encourage the reestablishment, or sometimes the first establishment of intimacy in the couple relationship, in order to make it possible to have sexual gratification. And they had read Sullivan, they had worked with Sullivan, and they knew that. They didn't invent it, they just applied it. A lot of other confirmation of Sullivan I get comes here at UVM with students who talk about their relationships that are sexual and all the problems that they create, and the anxiety and the loneliness people feel in the relationship of not because they're not being intimate, and they're being sexual, and they think that ought to be enough, but they're missing the intimacy. Yes?
I actually find this very interesting, and I just want to give you another example.
Sure. Yep. And one of the keys to that is that people are forced to talk to each other and share their feelings and thoughts. If you don't, the email is pretty dull. You know, you can only go so long on your cell phone or your email talking about what you had for lunch, which has nothing to do with intimacy. And if you're going to maintain the relationship, eventually you have to talk about what's important, and that is the basis for intimacy. How you feel, what you think, what do you think is important in the world? What are you thinking about? What's exciting you? Now you have to share those feelings in order to create the intimacy. And couples who spend their time talking with each other about the important things are doing that and then laying the groundwork for having a good sexual relationship. Because they can talk to each other. They've learned to listen to each other. They've learned to be intimate. That, without the intimacy, the sex without the intimacy, is recreation. It's not a relationship. I had, a number of years ago, a student gave me an example from her own life here at UVM, back in the days before AIDS. Things were different before AIDS. And she described having spent her 20s during and after UVM in Burlington having a lot of sexual relationships. One night, two night, going downtown, finding somebody to have sex with, and instead there was a large group of people who spent their time, their recreational time, having sex with each other, and you knew who was good and who wasn't, and you developed very good skills, but none of the relationships were intimate. And you know, eventually, she said, she got up to 27 or so and began to want to have a relationship. And so she stopped having sex and was able then to develop an intimate relationship and eventually get married and was happily married with a couple of kids by the time she took the course. So it was fine. But she gave me a term, and if you're listening to this on the web, sorry. And I loved it. I'd only used the term recreational sex before that, but she gave me that term, which is absolutely perfect. It is a sport in the same way that playing flute duets or violin concertos or something is recreational, or playing tennis with somebody who's good. But it's not an intimate interpersonal relationship. And it's not the basis for an intimate interpersonal relationship. The intimate interpersonal relationship is the basis for a long-term relationship that is sexually gratifying, that's going to last you the rest of your life. Okay. So, that's Sullivan. I like him. Oh, one other point. What is an intimate relationship? An intimate relationship requires mutual self-disclosure, mutual concern and interest, thoughtfulness about the other person's feelings and ideas, and acceptance of difference. Acceptance of difference. Sullivan says it has to be a relationship that is mutual, that is, you both have to be involved in it. It has to be reciprocal. It is collaborative. And it is between equals. It means an intimate relationship is between people who are at the same stage of human life. So he says the relationship that, or the intimacy that a high school student establishes with a high school teacher can't actually be intimate, or if it is, you're going to lose your job, because it can't be reciprocal. You're not really equals. There's a power differential and a stage differential, but kids often don't understand that. So it's teachers' responsibility to make sure that the relationships do not become mutual and reciprocal. Reciprocal means that you can take turns listening, supporting, talking, you know, that you're doing both, rather than what often happens in a relationship is that one of us is a really good listener and the other one is happy to talk. But when you try to reverse the roles, it can't be done. It's one of the things you learn in a friendship is how to tell the other person to shut up and listen. And have the person say, oh, I'm sorry, you know, okay. Talk. And know how to actually listen. Actively listen and understand you and ask you questions that are going to help you understand yourself. That's the task in an intimate relationship. Helping each other understand. I can't pick the right pronouns to finish that sentence. The two people are trying to understand themselves and each other in the context of the relationship. And that's mutual and it's reciprocal. And it's a collaborative task. Collaborative is distinguished from cooperative because when you cooperate with somebody, somebody is telling you what to do and they're leading and you're following. But in an intimate relationship, you're doing things together. You're talking through plans and ideas so that you're creating them jointly. They're not his idea and her idea, or her idea and her idea. They're our idea that we create together. And it's that creation of ideas together that creates the intimacy and makes the relationship last. So you can work together to figure out what you're going to do next, how you're going to raise your kids, how you're going to live, how you're going to cohabit, how you're going to have sex. All of those things are collaboratively decided by two equals mutually involved in a reciprocal set of activities and a reciprocal relationship. That does not come easily. That is hard work. It takes a lot of practice, a lot of luck in finding somebody who is at the same point in life and who feels the same way you do about the importance of establishing a relationship. And what most of us do is spend a lot of time trying to find somebody who's interested in developing those skills with us. And they're not going to happen just because you go to bed with each other. In fact, they're less likely to happen if you just go to bed with each other. Okay, I'll get off that soapbox. Questions about Sullivan before I leave him in the dust? Your parents have an intimate relationship that is sexually gratifying? We've already talked about that. Yes? With security, but not intimacy. Sorry, I was afraid that's what you were going to say. A good sport fucking relationship has a form of intimacy in it because people have agreed on what their goals are and what they're going to do. It's secure because of that agreement. That people know there are no strings, that you are interested in not just your own pleasure, and this is an important point, very important point. It's not your own pleasure. You are a good sport if you are creating pleasure for the other person. So it's a collaborative, mutual, reciprocal activity that has sufficient trust to be secure and sufficient communication, at least on this one topic, to be able to have a sexually gratifying experience for both people. And you can do that. Many people get married without intimacy. Many people have sexual relationships without intimacy. And in my work with divorcing couples, I am used to hearing one or both talk about the problem in the relationship. And the problem in the relationship is usually loneliness. I wish I had $100 for everybody I've heard say, yeah, we have good sex, but even when we're having sex, I feel really lonely. No. There's no connection. There's no connection. He doesn't understand me. She doesn't understand me. She never listens to me. She doesn't know how I feel. And that can come from one person or the other, but if it comes from either of them, the relationship is in deep trouble. Because they're not understanding each other. They're not trying to do that. Or they're trying, but it's not mutual, it's not reciprocal, they don't have the skills. And sadly, people can go through life without ever having a really intimate relationship. It's hard work. It's hard work. Other question? Yes.
Do you find that second marriages tend to work better at it? I mean, it's not like if it's a person that's married like 4 or 5 times, but if it's like one marriage gets divorced and then they don't like have a second marriage.
The question is, do second marriages tend to work better? Not according to the statistics. Second marriages are more likely to end in divorce than first marriages. Now, there are a number of reasons for that, and one of those is children. People tend to get married the first time without children, and they can establish the relationship. When you acquire stepchildren, particularly young ones, how anybody creates a step-parenting, that's tough too. So the statistics are that second marriages don't work particularly well. On the other hand, my personal experience, of course, is that second marriages do work better. Today is our 71-month anniversary. Thank you. Where was I going with that? And what happened, I think the balance, or perhaps the contributing factor to that, is that when you happen to get married when you're in your 40s and have had other marriages or serious relationships, by the time you're in your 40s, you've figured out what you can live with and what you can't live without, and what you have to have in a relationship. And you've also, if you've worked at it, learned to have an intimate relationship, or at least are interested in doing that, and having a mutually satisfying relationship. So if you are a grown-up when you get married, if both people are grown-ups, you're much more likely to be able to put together an intimate relationship. Another reason I think that second marriages do so poorly is that so many people leave their first marriages for somebody else or get remarried immediately before they've figured out what went wrong the first time. So they're, and I'll talk about that probably not, maybe next week. The tendency is to go from one marriage where you're blaming the other person for everything that went wrong into another relationship that is supposed to be perfect, and you're going to blame that person for everything that goes wrong. And the trick is never develop a relationship with somebody who is still blaming his or her ex. Uncle Larry's rule. If you're dating after a breakup of a relationship, or somebody else, you're dating somebody who has broken up, if they're still talking about what the other person did that was wrong, run. When they start talking about what they did that was wrong and how they contributed to the relationship, or why they got into a bad relationship and how they want the next one to be, and they're talking about creating an intimate relationship, then you can stick around for a while and see if something develops. But the number of people who run into another relationship immediately when they haven't learned anything from their past mistakes is really frustrating. Thank you. That was a good question.
Do you think that you can build intimacy, or does it usually just happen when you click with someone?
The question is, do I think you can build intimacy, or does it just happen when you click? I think it tends to start because both people are ready for it to start. And it's not the lust stuff. It's not the I'm physically attracted to you. It's the, oh my, you're easy to talk to. And both people are able to do that. When you find yourself meeting somebody and you're sharing things you didn't even know you knew about yourself and your feelings and you're interested in the other person, that's clicking. And then you can build on that. But if both people are interested in having a relationship, you do have to construct the intimacy. Oh, I'm a constructivist, remember. It's not going to happen automatically. You're not going to develop those skills unless you work at them. You have to practice them, and it helps if you're practicing with somebody who's also practicing and can help you. So you build that set of skills, and along with it, you build the relationship because of the intimacy. But it has to be a mutual thing that you're both interested in doing, and it's part of the relationship. I was delighted to hear a woman who's in her mid-20s recently say that the relationship that she's in now was different from most of the others she's ever had, because she and her boyfriend just sit around and talk about everything. And she says, you know, it's really interesting. She's never been with a guy who was just willing to talk about anything and everything with her. And he listens. He actually cares what she thinks. And I said, yes, all right, go for it. Practice. You know.
I might be getting this confused, but I have a sort of a problem with the security with girlfriend's issue, because I think you can make the confusion that love has something to do with dependency, but in my opinion, it has nothing to do with dependency.
Right.
Because if there's dependency, then when that need is not getting met, there's going to be conflict, which leads to an unhealthy relationship. And I'm wondering if you can make that clear to me on what security is.
Yes. Thank you. That's a really nice question to get me to go back and remind you that we're talking about security in relationships that start with the mother-infant relationship, where dependency is a normal and natural part of that. And as you develop, you acquire more peers to have secure relationships with. So your friends, when you're 4 years old, you can have secure relationships with your friends. They're not going to be intimate. But you can have comfortable relationships where there's no threat in them. And that means you're good playmates. You like the same things and you're roughly equal in your skills, or you're thoughtful with each other. So there's not threat and there's not anxiety created by the friendship that you're creating. So each of our relationships has different potential and different ways of being anxiety producing. And what you're doing is building a repertoire of secure relationships, or the ability to make them secure, or the wisdom to get out of them. Like the 5-year-old who says, I don't want to play with her anymore because she's nasty, she's mean. What the nasty and mean means is, this is an insecure relationship, so it's not going to be important for me. If you're talking about relationships that have intimacy, then you're talking about adolescence and up, so you've got to have the experience of intimacy, or the need for it, and the experience of loneliness. The anxiety can be produced by anything that you put into the relationship that suggests you're not satisfied in the relationship. Part of what having a secure relationship that's intimate is that you stop expecting other people to make you secure. So you're not dependent on being in the relationship for it to be secure. And in an adult relationship, it's important that you know you're just fine without a relationship. That you can be in a relationship and that's fine. And if the other person has a problem, take this back to Bowen. Remember Bowen and the notion of differentiation? A mature relationship, a secure relationship, is easier if both people know they don't have to have it. They don't have to be in this relationship. It's a choice. And you're not responsible for the other person's happiness. You might want to please the other person. That would be nice. I like that. You want to understand the other person. You want to know the other person. And you want the other person to know you. So you've made that commitment to knowing each other and to helping each other feel secure. Anything you do that creates anxiety for the other person needs to be talked about. But if the other person is anxious just because that person wants to be in the relationship with you and is scared to death not to be in it, that's going to interfere with the intimacy, and it's going to be an anxious and insecure relationship for that person. So if you're in the situation of feeling anxious all the time in a relationship, maybe you're not ready to be in one. Or you're picking people who are threatening you and are not comfortable and easy to be with.
The reason I brought that up is because I think in college I see as relationships as being used the same way drugs are. It's an escape from yourself. And if you have another person that's mutually reaffirming the fact that you don't know yourself enough, then it's easy for there to be conflict. And I don't think that is healthy, or you can define that as love. So I think that it's good to define love as something that's completely free of you using that relationship as an escape.
You have confirmation from the seat in front of you. Right on. And I thought that's where the earlier comment about the long-distance relationship might be going. Because in part what some people use the long-distance relationship for is to avoid developing intimate relationships here. What some people do. They've got the boyfriend or the girlfriend out there, so they're off limits. And they use that as a way of avoiding developing intimate relationships here. Not to mention sexual, but they just don't have the intimate relationships. And that's always suspect for me. So I usually recommend to people, if it's not already an intimate relationship, that you dump the person and work on relationships that are here, but not to the detriment of studying for HDFS-5, which can happen, because this is the time of life when most of us, for you, are developing and rehearsing and refining the skills of intimacy, trying to figure out how to have a close relationship that is secure. And you will go through perhaps many relationships before you get there. But each of them should contribute to your skill so that you have more and more ability to express yourself and to understand and to know the other person. But what happens, and this is a timely place to put this comment, what happens for us is that intimacy is an incredibly powerful emotion. It is an incredibly powerful emotion when you find that person. I can remember being 16, almost 17. I was 17, or I was a week away from being 17. I can tell you the date, and I can tell you the place, and I can tell you the swing set we were sitting on in what city in Missouri. Anyway, the first time in my life of having the experience of talking to somebody about how I felt about various things in life and listening to her talk about the same sorts of things and staying up well past midnight to the chagrin of our... I don't do that anymore. To the chagrin of our chaperones who were responsible for us. We were just sitting on the swings talking, and I remember very clearly that being aware this was the first time I've ever had that kind of conversation with a young woman who was incredibly attractive, and I was very attracted to her, and she was sitting over there and I was sitting over here, and there was some connection going on, and it was wonderful. And what happens to us is that we experience the intimacy and we mistake it for love. Intimacy is not love. Intimacy is an interpersonal connection with somebody else, and it can be many things, but it is a psychological way of communicating and understanding the other person. It is the basis for a loving relationship, but it is not enough. And you'll read as you go through Sternberg and others talking about the nature of love. Intimacy is part of love, but it's not love. So what happens to us is we get the experience of intimacy, we start to develop that skill, and we mistake it for all of the other things that are necessary. We propose, we become sexual, we get married, we have kids, and that's all fine if you continue to build the relationship. But often we're missing the other elements of a relationship that will be long-lasting. You can be intimate and not compatible. And one of the things you discover is that it's very different. You can be intimate, very, very close to somebody psychologically, but living with them and having kids with them just isn't going to work. You know, you're going to drive each other nuts. You'll be able to talk about it intimately, but you'll drive each other nuts. So you have very different values. You may both have the skill, but love isn't going to be what's happening. So the other thing that happens in our society is that we get married and then to the first person we have an intimate adult relationship with. And then along the way we discover something else really important. That we can have intimate communication with somebody else that we're not married to. Oh, by golly. Because we meet this person and we talk about work or whatever and we develop the intimacy there. And again, mistaking it for love, we decide, well, if I can be intimate with this person, if I can have that kind of closeness emotionally, then that means I don't love my spouse or my current partner, so I need to end that relationship and go have another one. And it's just disastrous. It's disastrous. But it's because we're confusing love and commitment for intimacy. You can have an intimate relationship with any number of people, including people that you don't love, people that you're not compatible with, people that you're not committed to, and you should keep that separate. Intimacy is one thing. It's a skill. You can exercise it all of your life with all different kinds of people, but it's not the base. It's an important component of, but it's not sufficient for a long-term, lasting, loving relationship that's going to be forever. But it's an important skill to practice and to explore. And it is the basis for our very close and long-lasting friendships. And I have an intimate relationship with the guy that I co-own a sailboat with, but I'm not going to marry him. Yeah. Our wives would not appreciate that. And I'm not attracted to him. But we have an intimate friendship. It's a very close friendship. Okay. So that to me is sort of the value of Erickson, is that he's giving you what the components are for the relationship, but he's suggesting a process of development that's going to happen all of your life as you develop relationships with different sorts of people. Thank you. Good question. Yes.
Please. Brought up in the foster system, mm-hmm. and he never had security or intimacy in his relationship, so he replaced it with sexual gratification.
Yep.
And in talking to him recently, I always thought he was being male and having a very large libido, but he's found somebody that he's secure and intimate with, and he can't. It seems like those places have reversed themselves. Is that a normal reaction for somebody that doesn't grow up with a secure, intimate foundation?
Interesting question. The question, as I understand it, is the guy has not had intimacy, and because he developed in the foster care system, he probably doesn't have secure attachments generally, but he's sexually just fine. Until he gets into a relationship that is intimate, where he's developing an attachment, and now the sex doesn't work. Right, okay. That's actually not terribly uncommon, because what you're learning, this is a very important point. What you are learning by having multiple non-intimate sexual relationships is the separation of sexuality from intimacy. And if you do that long enough and well enough, you may discover that the intimacy, when you finally develop a relationship with intimacy, interferes with the way you have learned to have sex. It interferes. And impotence in an intimate relationship, when you first start to develop an intimate relationship, is a very common experience if you have a lot of sexual experience before, because that sexual experience that you've had before is based on not caring much about knowing your partner. And when you want to know your partner and start thinking about your partner and feeling about your partner, you forget how to have sex. And it interferes with the arousal. So the relationship over a long period of time that you want is one where you have learned to be sexual together. And that is the intimacy in the relationship is the basis for that. It's often quite temporary. But also what happens is that sometimes, again, this is something we'll talk about, you'll read about, what you have is a relationship that is intimate, but it's not, in fact, very passionate. You can have an intimate relationship. I use the example of the guy I co-own a sailboat with. We have very intimate relationship, but there's no passion there. There's no erotic feeling. And sometimes we get ourselves into situations where we're trying to have the sexual relationship with somebody we're intimate with, and there really just isn't any sexual attraction. And that's why, for Sullivan, the goal is to get that relationship where you've got all three. But the intimacy is not a guarantee of sexual interest or passion or response. So sometimes it's just blocking. Sometimes it's just not there. And it's never going to be there. The chemistry's wrong. You know, person smells wrong skin texture, moves wrong, just not chemistry that you need. In the same way that, you know, if you're going to have an intimate relationship, you need to have the chemistry there too, if it's going to be sexual.
The guidelines for the exam analysis on the website?
Yes.
Yes?
Yeah.
And is there anything else? Like last time there was something posted on your door. Is that same here?
The exam key is there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was, I'm going
to... Good question.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm going to major in human development. I'm undeclared right now. I was wondering if I could meet with you sometime just to discuss that and just, like, talk to you about that, the program and stuff.
Yep.
Just, like, whenever would be a good time or whatever, but... Now is the stuff we're just getting into. I think it's so fascinating.
Yeah.
Have you read any Krishnamurti? Have you heard of him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I've been reading him, and I just like to talk to you about it. But I actually saw a great movie last night, What the Bleep Do We Know? Have you heard of it?
Yeah, I've heard of it. I haven't seen it.
You need to see it. It's great. But I just would like to talk to you about the program before I...
The easiest thing to do is email me and give me a couple of times that are good for you, and I'll put that together with my calendar.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Great. And I'm the person that... If you went to the dean's office and said, I want to major in human development, who do I talk to?
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. All right, thanks a lot.
Super.